it's subtle, right? That moment of release. Sometimes it's very subtle, I think. I have an image for myself sometimes, and I notice it particularly in meditation, where I'll get carried away with a thought train or an idea of usually myself that I'm building in my head, and I don't notice that taking me away until I do notice it. And the image in my mind is like that I've been in a hot air balloon, and it's going up, 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 kind of farther and farther out there, and that the rope or the chain is getting more and more taut as I get farther out. And then that moment of waking up to it, and it's like it goes, ah, and the rope relaxes a little bit, and I have a little bit of a sense of like coming back to ground. And a lot of times I don't notice it, I'm just on to the next thing that this graspy little mind wants to get at. So we're talking about the third noble truth this evening. In Pali, that's dukkha, nirodho, arya, satcha. It translates sort of like the cessation of stress and dissatisfaction is the truth of the noble ones. And Pali is the language that we have the Buddha's teachings written down in, hundreds of years after he first taught them. But these Four Noble Truths were, in fact, some of his first teachings and consistent teachings through many decades. And we've been going through a bit of a series talking about each one on different weeks for a few reasons. You know, one is, I know for me, when I was first getting to first finding my place in practice and learning more about what the Buddha taught, moving from a place of being like, well, yeah, if I was anything, I'd be Buddhist, but I have no idea what the Buddha might have said about anything, ever. You know, moving to that place to exploring the richness and profundity of the Buddha Dharma, learning some of these fundamental things like, the Four Noble Truths, this foundational practice, it helped me situate myself in my practice and helped me understand more clearly that I wanted to keep practicing and keep learning because it worked for me. It made sense as I was learning more about it. And I find now that just as the Buddha came back to some of these teachings again and again and again through decades, I find that for me, the way I can understand any of these teachings just continues to enrich my life. It's not like I learned the alphabet and I'm over it. There may come a time where I'm just so free of craving and suffering that I just don't need them anymore. But until then, you know, it's a real honor and delight to get to investigate these teachings and explore them with you. So as a quick recap, the first noble truth is this: calling out the elephant in the room and stating that there will be times of dissatisfaction and reactivity and stress in life. The second noble truth is that there's a cause to that stress. The word we use for stress is dukkha, or the word the Buddha may have used would have been dukkha. And that gets translated as stress or suffering or reactivity. So I'll use any of those tonight. So the second noble truth is that there's a cause of our experience of dukkha. And that cause is craving and clinging. and the way our minds get hooked onto things and our hearts get hooked onto things, and it gets real tight. The third noble truth is that there's cessation, there's hope, there's moments of release when that cycle of craving and dissatisfaction let go. And the fourth noble truth is a path, sort of action steps, about how we could cultivate more moments of cessation. I have to say, I have skipped over the third noble truth in times in my life because it felt sort of like a flimsy little bridge or punctuation mark to me. Like the first noble truth, suffering, yeah, I can feel that. The second noble truth, craving, oh, so juicy. And then we get over to the fourth noble truth, like what to do about it. I'm into my fixing mind, I'm into action, like, let's go. And the third noble truth just felt like a little bit of a hyphen or a comma, like, yeah, so there's a way out. Let's get to it, in my mind. But this is just it, right? This is just the subtlety of this moment of release and relaxation that is available to us. But maybe for some of us, not as exciting as the moments of total despair and the moments of, you know, action steps and escape. Just ease. I want to offer one framing for understanding the noble truths that we haven't talked about yet, and that's the idea that we might think of them as tasks rather than truths. Mm-hmm. Stephen Batchelor offers this idea. And we might particularly see that the first and second noble truth, this experience of dukkha caused by clinging, in some ways these are many of our sort of consistent experiences in life, and we may, in that sense, they may be truths for us, but we could also be invited to the task of really understanding them, being willing to see them head on and excavate them, rather than just wallow in them, which I've certainly done at times. Right? But then that the third and fourth noble truth, the truth of cessation and the path that leads to cessation, you know, these are really, they're an active decision that we can make about how we want to incline our energy and our attention. One of the words used in this truth, this task, nirodho or nirodha, it's a Pali word, and it's sometimes translated as unbinding. And I like that word. I like that idea a lot because for me it gets at this sensation, the loosening that can happen when I've been caught up and reactive in something. That moment of loosening, where something becomes unbound. I can sometimes feel that, right? Sometimes we do. But another word I like to use in my head for it, another translation I use for nirodho, is a surrender. You know, I don't remember where I first read or heard that suggested translation, but it really rings for me in some ways because surrender, you know, there's that phrase, sweet surrender, right? Like, I'm going to stop fighting. I'm going to stop resisting and fighting with how things are and how I want them to be. And I'm just going to surrender to how it is right now. One of those places, if you think of the battleground and think of a surrender, there could be an idea that this is ignoble in some way. You should have fought to the bitter end. I've done that. I've done the rounds of fighting to the bitter end with craving and clinging and suffering. And at some point, the nobility wore off in my experience. I'll be curious to know what your experience has been, but at a certain point, it just gets ugly on the battlefield. And it can be a really profound and noble thing to just surrender. I'll give you an example. I'm thinking of a marriage of mine that fell apart, and you know, it was a long time of this reactivity and aversion and craving and wanting it to be different, and a lot of craving and suffering around it. And at a certain point, my ex and I just looked at each other, and I don't know what had changed. I don't know why this moment was different than all of the previous moments, but we looked at each other and just said, what are we doing? Like, this just isn't working. And it was so sweet. It was just that moment of, oh, we surrender. I think we may have actually even smiled at each other for the first time in how long, and that we were just like, it was freedom. Like, oh, we don't have to keep doing this. There's an escape. There's a way out. So, the promise of the Buddha wasn't necessarily how to get out of a bad marriage. He had a bigger vision, and what we read in the suttas and what we hear handed down through so many generations of teachers is that this moment of awakening, like, for some people, there's an aim with spiritual practice to reach a state of complete enlightenment and awakening from where we're caught in greed and anger and delusion, aiming toward a complete cessation of that may be permanent. I'm struggling here. I'm just offering the facts as I read them in the suttas. It's not the way I am oriented in my practice. So I want to give full acknowledgement to the fact that I'm just going for the little moments of awakening, those little moments when things get looser. And I find that as I practice more, those moments come more frequently, and I'm able to see them and discern them more frequently. And it doesn't have to be practice on the cushion, you know, other ways of practicing in daily life. And that's, should all of those moments add up to like a fireworks worthy enlightenment for me, like, great, but it's not my orientation. However, we can understand the third noble truth as being that promise that is possible. The word we might use then is nibbana, which is total unbinding and awakening. These words are used in some places in the suttas. They're actually used interchangeably, nibbana or nirodha. They can carry some of the same meanings, but I think overall we might see nirodha potentially being a little bit more of those small moments, the release of suffering, or release of dukkha. I understand it in a bit of a more discreet way, and like the letting go of something negative, and I'm putting that in quotes. Whereas nibbana can have more of an ultimate sort of feeling to it. It's not necessarily about just the small moments. It's really an ultimate truth that we might come to. And in some some ways of understanding the teachings, nibbana can have more of a, air quotes again, more of a positive feeling, because while yes, it includes the release of being caught in greed, anger, and delusion, it also includes a quality of ease and well-being and lightness. The dictionary of Pali, the authoritative dictionary of Pali, I've been told, defines Nibbana in part as coming to an end of the fuel for rebirth and the possibility of rebirth, freedom from all concerns and passions, a sense of well-being, ease, happiness, experienced through knowledge of this freedom in oneself, freedom from care or passion, a sense of bodily well-being, ease, happiness. Sounds pretty good. And I'll take it, even if it's just the little moments. I have a teacher who, I like the way he frames it. He talks about being in the neighborhood of Nibbana, and that any time we are having that moment of awakening from where we've been caught up and reactive, any time we have that moment, we're in the neighborhood of Nibbana. Even if it means that what we're awakening to is the truth of present moment experience that's difficult or painful or doesn't feel good in some way. It's not to say that everything feels happy and light, but just that we've stopped resisting it and we're just sitting in a really clear and truthful and honest way with what is. Ah, we're in the neighborhood of Nibbana then. They might let me into the neighborhood. That might be a reasonable goal. And there's one more Pali word I want to throw out there because I like it a lot, and it captures a sense of what I think is possible for us when we're practicing in a way to cultivate these moments of cessation. And that word is citta. It refers to an awakened heart and mind where our experience of practice, our experience in the moment is infused with a quality of compassion and wisdom and clear seeing, real tenderness of the heart. And I think that is what is available to us when we have those moments of cessation, when things loosen up a little. Not necessarily that we feel happy. That quality of citta can feel really so tender sometimes that it almost hurts, yeah? Mm-hmm. When we're that awake to what this present moment has to offer and maybe what the person in front of us is going through, or, you know, different moments can feel real, real tender, but there's something real clean about those moments too, really awake. So how do we do it? How do we get there? That's the topic for next time in part, but I do want to focus a little bit on how we can really bring our practice to investigating this cessation idea. One that I find valuable is just to start with the little things in hope that we might build some momentum that can carry us through to some of the bigger ones. So anytime we're practicing with relinquishment or letting go, anytime we're consciously investigating that as a practice, we're investigating the third noble truth. So it may just be letting go of I always pick on chocolate. I won't do it tonight. Coffee. Let's say coffee. We've decided to give up our morning cup of coffee, right? It doesn't have to be like a big, loaded, heavy-duty thing that we're going to relinquish. It could just be exploring what it's like to give up coffee for a while. I have a friend...
But maybe you want to give up the coffee for...
Well, I wouldn't. I don't
want
to.
Why is it a problem? Why is it an issue that the third noble truth has to involve?
I think it's not necessarily that it would be a problem or an issue. It's that the practice would be just examining what it's like to give up something that we're in a habit of. It doesn't have to be a problem at all. But what's it like for us to let go? I have a friend who's a monastic who makes a regular practice of this with coffee. She likes coffee. She has coffee regularly. And she also regularly doesn't, just to continue practicing and noticing how her mind goes to, oh, I want a cup of coffee. That's craving and clinging. If I'm not going to get my cup of coffee, am I going to suffer? Is that stressful? That's dukkha. It's not the end of the world if I don't get that cup of coffee. So maybe I could just practice with that and see what it's like to give it up.
But what are you in training for? We're not going to reach a point in the world where there's a shortage of coffee and we have to give it up permanently, are we?
We don't know.
I mean, we know we're going to die, so there's some logic to being in training for being dead or dying.
That's right.
But there doesn't seem any intrinsic merit in practicing to give up coffee, unless you're saying it's a small thing.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah, no, this was on the list of small things.
Yeah. Sort of practice for giving up clinging. It doesn't really matter what it is in that sense, I think.
So it's coffee, like a Christian at Lent, giving things up for Lent.
Yeah. What about giving up alcohol? Or meat?
Sure.
Or air travel?
Or wearing the color red or yellow. I mean, it doesn't matter what it is. It's just practicing with the little things and seeing how we go, seeing how we feel, paying attention in a low stakes environment.
Well, Helen Garner gave up sex at 55, mm-hmm. and she's now 75. So I guess that was giving up in a fairly big way, wasn't it?
Maybe. Maybe.
Just giving up, and then there's, not necessarily the choice of
not being
up
at all.
No, I think these are really relevant and excellent questions, and abstaining and relinquishing are part of, as you pointed to, many spiritual paths include opportunities to consciously investigate what it would be like to abstain from all kinds of different things. Not everybody chooses to engage in those practices, and that's not mine to decide for somebody else. Yeah.
It does. When you give something up, it almost like it highlights the wanting, the clinging, the grasping, and so that in itself, might if you continue as normal, it may not be so obvious. You make. Effort at something, as Lulu's saying, something small, it's like, oh, gee, actually that's interesting, that level of sort of, it just highlights something in our world that we may not have acknowledged so much.
But wouldn't it be praiseworthy to enjoy coffee or sex without being attached to them? Wouldn't that be a practice in itself, to not be attached to the act of drinking coffee, but to drink it without attachment, in the same way that we're enjoying the air conditioning, but we may not necessarily discriminate about whether it's good or bad, or a good thing to be cool or hot.
How do you even learn how to give up attachment? It's just like a way of showing you when you have attachment, how it's showing up, because it applies to all your attachments, which is normally not just coffee or whatever.
There's
a mind grabbing onto thoughts of how it wants things to be and stuff that happens every day.
There's another element to cessation here that which goes a little bit off the grain to of Batchelor's kind of task way of looking at it. And what we've been talking about thus far is the act of cessation. And that implies a doing and a volition that comes from a type of conditionality.
Mm.
But then there's another kind of cessation that just arises.
Mm-hmm.
And for me, the ground of practice is to some extent in the hope of having more of those sorts of moments to see more deeply into what cessation kind of is, okay. And what that means. And then, you know, to have that space and clarity to see, you know, the mechanisms in motion and get clarity around that. So what's kind of, yeah, it's, and then there is the thing around, you know, having these containers of whether it's rules or needing to give up stuff and you know, they kind of act as a container, like the vinaya of the monks, of the you know, monks and nuns, kind of all those bloody rules, you know, they just keep knocking up against them. and that process in itself kind of brings it back into something that's more deeply essential.
I'm wondering too if the idea that suffering comes and goes is really helpful, because the biggest pain I've experienced is when I've actually felt like something will last forever. It's stuffed and it's going to last forever, and it's terrible and it's going to last forever, and it's going to affect everything. And that's the time where I felt the most like excruciating anguish about something, or something that I've done that I can't undo, that's big, that sort of anguish. So I think thinking about sensation in a sense, like remembering it, I remember there was a time when I was bullied where I thought about it 24/7. I hardly think about it at all now. I think, oh, okay. So if I come across something else really difficult, I can think, well, gee, I had some huge things in the past that I was totally obsessed with and I felt terrible, but now they don't even register. It's like I have to make an effort to think of them. And so I find that really freeing. And it allows me to put a lot of energy into some things right now, rather than fearing that I'm going to be annihilated, and facing some things, you know, like the state of the world, rather than denying them out of some fear that I'll be annihilated, or I'll get lost in something, or I'll be killed by it, or whatever. So I actually find that philosophically actually really helpful. And I find it really helpful in my work too, that people can be in extreme crisis, but it doesn't mean it's going to last forever. And there are things that you can do, but sometimes even just having a philosophical concept that it won't last forever, and you know, you might, who knows, grow from it or learn from it or benefit from it or I don't know, whatever it might be. I find that really freeing. And I think it helps you be more content when crap things happen, but it's part of life, and that it's not like I haven't done anything wrong, or it's just something happening. And it helps me be more sort of philosophical, I think, and less likely to get angry about other people that they're doing this to me, or they're stuffing me around, or you know what I mean. So I actually find it very helpful.
You might like one of the handy-dandy Zen tricks then around addressing our clinging and our dukkha, and that would be more of an inquiry: who is clinging? Where is the mind that is experiencing stress and reactivity? And that, like, looking for the experiencer of it. It's not maybe so much taught in sight, but the Zennies are big on that kind of reflection.
That stuff spins me out a little bit.
So you brought out the impermanence. Thank you also, Angela, for pointing toward the dependent nature of some of this, and that really, Nibbana is the idea that is just beyond dependent conditioning. We would be free regardless of what the situation or the environment had to offer if we were dwelling in that heart place. In a good old sort of traditional way to work with it, we might focus on the bring attention to the default direction that our heart and mind are moving us in, and notice whether that's moving us toward freedom or toward increasing constriction. And that can also be broken down a little bit further to say, focus on the drawbacks of sense pleasures. If we find ourselves in the midst of clinging and craving, whether it's for physical things, you brought up alcohol, right, and coffee, or whether it's for, I don't know, appearing a certain way, cultivating a certain identity, when we feel ourselves stirring up that train, you know, keeping that train moving, painting that picture more and more of how much we'd really like that outcome, we can notice, is that moving me closer to freedom or not? It may not be. That's a little hint here. When we're stirring up how much we really want this thing, this person, this outcome, we may not be moving ourselves closer to freedom. And what we could do instead is actually reflect on what the drawbacks might be. That's at least reflecting on the drawbacks of how it might go for us if we kept on moving toward that ever-tightening need for the outcome to be a certain way. And we might also, on the flip side, reflect on what would the benefits be if I was able to hold this more lightly and let go. We may not be there yet. You know, sometimes it is just a perspective shift that we could entertain without actually feeling like we're there yet. But what would it be like to be able to let go of the cup of coffee or whatever else? Yeah?
Well, if you're aging, you have a daily experience of having to let go, and you have a daily experience of pain and suffering. So in that sense, life forces you to engage with those issues. But I don't necessarily see that. I mean, in some senses, sensory pleasures are a compensation for the pain of suffering. And I find it a way of getting through.
Yes.
You know.
Yes. The Buddha started his teaching on the Four Truths. I'll read a bit from one of the translations of the suttas. There are two dead ends which should not be pursued. Which two? Addiction to pleasure through indulging in sensuality, which is low, village-like, pertaining to the unawake person, undignified and unfulfilling. And so that's on one side, the addiction to pleasure. On the other side is addiction to self-punishment, which is painful, undignified, and unfulfilling. The middle way does not lead to the two dead ends, but makes for vision and knowledge, is conducive to calm, lucid understanding, awakening, and the cessation of ignorance and suffering. And what is the middle way, practitioners? It's the Four Noble Truths that we'll get to next time. So, yeah, there's room for the middle way.
So you know, in that, he wasn't talking about how pleasures are bad in themselves. He's talking about attachment to pleasures.
And attachment to suffering, too.
Right, yeah.
So how does that fit in with the monastic way, then, where they are, in fact, giving up all sensual pleasures?
Well,
what is the some higher virtue in pursuing that path?
Look, they're giving up some sensual pleasures.
Sovana has not given up her coffee. My friend has not given up her coffee.
Right, okay. Look, you know, living a life that is sometimes retreat-like can have, you know, as monastics do, can have simple pleasures of just being there with nature. It's not, I don't think it's giving up all sensual pleasures. You know, sure, it's giving up sex, it's giving up going to concerts, probably.
Yeah, no movies.
Hmm?
No movies.
No movies?
No movies.
Although in Thailand, you know, you still might smoke, but they used to.
Kerry, what have you?
Part of the secret to this would be developing a sense of non-attachment. Would you say that you'd be embarking on the road, the right path of it, to achieve that outcome? Yeah.
So in that sense, engaging in the pleasure is testing your level of attachment, isn't it?
Mm.
It's a form of practice. Cessation of pleasure could be a form of practice, or engaging in pleasure without attachment.
Don't know you're attached until you try to do without it.
Yeah.